show. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. And a quick note before the morning show starts here in just a couple of seconds. You can actually watch it live on Facebook, facebook.com. Go to facebook.com/WGTDFM and join Greg and his guest, Kenosha artist Dan Simino, live in just a couple of seconds.
And we welcome you to the morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on this very special occasion, I'm very excited to be able to speak with a tremendously gifted artist. His name is Dan Simino. And Dan Simino is renowned in several different media, but is especially well known as an acrylic painter. As a matter of fact, he is president of the International Society of Acrylic Painters, a member of one of America's most prestigious art societies, the Samagundi Club. And we are talking to Dan Simino today primarily because of an exciting new exhibit of his work that is about to open at the Blue Moon Gallery in Grays Lake, Illinois. Grays Lake, if you have not been there, is a lovely community just across the border, roughly a half hour from downtown Kenosha. And this exhibit is going to be running there at the Blue Moon Gallery from October 22nd to November 15th with a special opening reception on Saturday, October 26th. And we have this opportunity to not only talk with Dan Simino, but because we are in a visual medium as well as audio today, we are actually going to be able to examine a couple of his marvelous paintings that he has brought with him today and talk with him in some detail about the work of a painter and artist. Dan Simino, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Glad to be here.
I'm so happy that that this is happening, and I am grateful to your partner, Len Iaquinta, for suggesting it. It's a wonderful opportunity for us to get to know you and to understand more about the work that you do. Let's begin by learning a little bit about who you are in terms of your roots. From our chat just before we went on the air, I understand you are from the beautiful state of Maine.
Yes.
Tell us something about your childhood in Maine and maybe something about your introduction to art during your earliest years.
Okay. I was born in Lewiston, Maine. My parents are still there, and I have a sister who still lives in Maine. From a very early age, I was always drawing on anything available to me. And I had an uncle by marriage that was an artist, and he saw what I was doing. And so he actually started me off on my path to my artwork. When I was about 5 or 6 years old, he bought me a pad of drawing paper, pencils, art pencils, and he started buying me the Walter Foster art books. And he suggested that I start drawing the Sunday comics in the paper. as a way to learn how to see and how to draw. And so I started doing that right away.
In other words, copying the comics.
Copying the comics, yes. And not tracing, but actually drawing what I saw.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that was my start. And then at about 12 years old, I actually started formal art lessons. We had a new art store that opened in town that was offering art lessons. It was the first time we'd seen something like that in the area. And so my parents enrolled me, and I started drawing sessions and no painting at that time. But then a couple years later, the artist who took over those courses decided to do private lessons. And a woman from town and I were the only two students that he took. Hmm. And my parents bought me an oil painting set, and I started oil painting. I didn't like oil. There was too slow a dry time, and it was messy and stinky. And my parents had the old steam radiators in our house. So what I would do is I would paint, and at night I would actually put the painting on top of the radiator facing the wall so the heat would raise up and dry the paint so I could work on dry paint the next day. Eventually I found acrylic paint, and while it was a hard learning curve to get used to it, I switched to that and just loved it from that point forward, and I've been doing it ever since.
Wonderful. We'll hear about your formal schooling in terms of higher education in a second. I want to rewind to what you were mentioning about these books that your, was it your uncle that
yes.
gave you? Wallace Foster, did you?
Walter Foster books.
Walter Foster. So tell us what was in these books. I've never seen anything like that.
They're still available today, actually, in a slightly different format. You'll find them in like a Hobby Lobby or a Michaels and so forth. And they're art instruction books. Some of the books were actually authored by Disney animators or other famous painters. And it was just a series, like if it was drawing and it was, let's say, Disney characters, they would show you how to capture the basic shapes first. And then add on to those shapes until you got your final image. The painting books actually showed step-by-step instances of the painting so you could see how the painting was built, basically.
Wow. You mentioned that at some point you made what you kind of almost characterize it like a leap. I mean, kind of a dramatic step into painting.
Yes.
From the drawing that you had done before. Explain why that is, in a sense, such a leap. What is profoundly different about painting versus drawing?
Wow. It's I would say what my response is going to be more personal. Every artist looks
sure.
differently. With painting, to me, it's more about sculpting the form in a two-dimensional format. Where drawing, you're capturing, if you're doing just line drawing, you're capturing the form just by structure, like a wireframe, basically. Where with the painting, what I say a lot when I teach art is, you people will disagree with me, but you don't have to know how to draw to know how to paint. Because a lot of people will say, I don't want to take your class because I don't know how to draw. And with painting, what I typically will do and suggest to my students is that they just get the base lines down to say where the objects need to go on the canvas. And from there, you just work with the color and the tone of the color to build the form that you see.
Interesting. And of course, painting can be in a lot of different forms.
Yes.
And you mentioned the fact that you started with oils, which you did not like, and then eventually switched to acrylic, which you did like more. And of course, there's this thing called watercolor, and
yes.
I'm sure there's other forms as well. But I've interviewed a couple of people who specialized in watercolor, in which the element of water is and its unpredictability is sort of introduced into the mix. Has that been very much a part of what you have done?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I do watercolor as well. I'm a signature member of several watercolor societies. Watercolor is one of the most difficult mediums, and they've probably said the same to you.
Yes.
It is very unpredictable. There are some artists who have it mastered where they know exactly what the water is going to do. I'm not that person. But I do keep my feet wet and do a couple watercolors per year, but my focus is the acrylic work. I love the feeling of the brush pushing against the canvas and resisting back at you, where paper being flat and taped down doesn't give you that same feel.
Interesting. So you were studying this all the way through, it sounds like, grade school and high school and so on. Would you characterize this as sort of an all-consuming passion of yours, or did you have other passions that tended to compete for your attention from time to time?
Well, a funny story, in my view. When the art classes started, my mom was a bowler, and she bowled every week, and I loved bowling, too. And we weren't a rich family. My parents were both blue-collar mill workers, and when it came time to take art classes, I also wanted to be on a bowling league. I had to decide which one was the most important because my parents could only afford one of them.
Wow.
So art won out.
Art beat out bowling. Very good. Well, I guess we're glad we did. I'm sorry for the bowling world that they lost out on your talent, but the art world has gained access to all the things you've given us. And so you did your college work at the University of Southern Maine, which is located where?
There are two campuses, Portland, Maine, which is the largest city in the state, and Gorham, Maine, which is a smaller town about a half hour from Portland. And the art campus was primarily in the Gorham campus.
Very good. And it sounds like you explored a lot of different things there. This actually prompts the question of what would you say the role of the state of Maine has played in shaping you, and particularly shaping you as an artist. I mean, what was it like to grow up in a state like Maine and in the particular communities where you lived and where you experienced art versus exploring art in a place like, for instance, New York City or Los Angeles, California?
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, there wasn't a lot of exposure to fine art there. There was, by the time I got to college, there was the Portland Museum of Art, which has some stellar artists like Andrew Wyeth, for example, a Maine artist, Marsden Hartley, another fantastic Maine artist. But in Maine, something I point out to my partner, Len, is like the autumns here, for example, are rather sedate and subdued, where there it's like full color, high saturation, incredible. And the colors there and just the terrain, Maine being unique in that we have the ocean, we have the foothills, and we have the mountains all within like an hour or two from each other. So you get to experience that whole world. Maine being one of the earliest states as well, part of Massachusetts back in the 13 colonies time. A lot of, well, actually the building I grew up in was built prior to 1776.
Wow.
So a lot of history there. The majority of the mill buildings where my parents worked and my family worked were all built in the 1850s, 1870s with this beautiful red brick. So you got all of this beautiful old history there, the history of maritime fishing, lobster fishing, and so forth along the coast. So there was all this incredible subject matter that was available all around me and all this beauty, and to want to capture that beauty was real inspirational.
I'm sure. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today with renowned artist Dan Simoneau, probably most well-known as a painter, a marvelous painter, and we're talking ahead of the opening of a special exhibit of his work called Quartet for Mind and Soul at the Blue Moon Gallery in Grays Lake, Illinois, an exhibit that will open on the 22nd of October and run through the middle of November. So at what point did you entertain the serious notion of doing this professionally, of not just doing art for fun, but of really weaving it into your professional life and professional identity?
It actually started in high school. When I was about 14 or 15 years old, I mentioned my art teacher that taught me painting and the woman who was with me in the classes. She became my next art instructor. And she taught every day of the week after school, about 20 students per day. And through her, I started learning about these, what we had, it's, were called sidewalk art festivals. And I started exhibiting in those while I was in high school at about 14 or 15.
Wow.
With the adults. And I was selling my work. And I joined the local art society. I was the youngest member ever to join at the time. So I was really focused on becoming a professional artist back then, about 15 or 16 years old. I wanted to be an architect, so I did all the math and stuff in school to prepare for that when I went to college. And then I learned how long it took to go to school for architecture and switch to fine arts at that point.
Funny how that works.
Yeah.
So if we looked at, for instance, some of those works that you were selling as a 14-year-old and a 15-year-old, would we recognize this as your work, I mean, compared to what you do now?
I think so, yeah. The maritime work that's on my website, there are pieces that are very similar to what I did back then. And I have been doing boats and lighthouses forever. That's what's there. But there is a continuous consistency throughout the work from very early on all the way to now.
Very good. And what? How does this figure in your professional life now?
Well, it's interesting. My company just interviewed me as well this week, and I am an IT professional. I'm a business analyst and a project manager for one of the largest IT consulting firms in the world. And what I find as an advantage is, being an artist, I have a tendency to think in a different way than someone who has gone, for example, for a business degree or has gone that path full bore. So I have a tendency to look at the problems put before me from my clients in a different perspective, from a completely different point of view, and can be much more creative in the solution that I give them. And on the opposite end, I find myself much more technical in how I approach my painting. It's not as, you'll hear a lot artists saying, you know, oh, I only paint when it inspires me or when I feel the inspiration hit me. I'm not that way. I'm very structured. I try to get 20 to 30 hours of painting a week in. You have to look at it as a business and treat it as a business and set work hours and so forth. But even when I was in high school, I had a programmable calculator. And that was before we had enlargers and all that type of thing. I would take my photos and I would measure, and I had built a program in the calculator that would then convert that to the right size for the canvas. And I would put the little dots in based on that and then connect them and have my drawing.
Wow. Boy, you're giving nice testimony to STEAM.
Yes.
Versus STEM.
Yes.
That is, we hear so much about STEM education and the STEM fields, and when we turn it to STEAM, we're inserting A for art right in the middle
yes.
of it all.
Yes.
And you are a living proof of the wisdom of not forgetting about the arts, even when someone is interested in purely technical fields.
Definitely. Definitely.
Very good. I'm glad you said that. In just a minute or two, we're going to look at two paintings that you have brought with you. I mean, the actual paintings. And for people who are viewing the morning show, they will be able to see it. And otherwise, we'll try to make sure that we give a good verbal description for people who end up only hearing this interview. I know from consulting some of what you have talked about in terms of your work that one of the primary sources of inspiration for you is the effect of light on
exactly.
objects, and that this is a hallmark of your work. I want to just insert something that is of slightly peripheral and yet right on target. As a voice teacher, which is what I do outside of the radio station, I often talk about a term in voice lessons that was originally a painting term, namely chiaroscuro,
yes.
this famous Italian term, which you're obviously well acquainted with in a different way. But in a voice studio, chiaroscuro means the perfect balance of bright and dark in a tone. So you don't want, when someone is singing, for the sound to be kind of swallowed and woofy and overly dark, and you also don't want it to be too bright to the point of being sort of strident and unpleasant, but you want those two elements both to be present in just the right balance. And whether a note is a high note or a low note or what kind of effect you're trying to create, that balance of bright and dark, the chiaroscuro, will be a little bit different in its specifics. But originally that term was coined for paintings,
yes,
and especially when certain painters were able to create this incredible effect that had never been seen before. Can you enlighten us a little bit about that concept of chiaroscuro in painting? I would especially love to know, selfishly, some of the historical context of that, and I think that will nicely segue into an examination of the paintings you've brought with you today.
Okay. One of my inspirations from college, when I started taking my art history classes, was an Italian painter called Caravaggio.
Oh, yeah.
Caravaggio was noted for his intense light-dark contrasts in his paintings, which caused a tension, but also caused an energy and an excitement when you looked at the piece. He would take traditional biblical stories and turn them on their end, basically, because of how he captured them. You'd look at other artists painting the same scenes, and they were rather sedate and something that you would look at and say, oh, that's nice, and walk on.
Right.
Where
and there'd be no difference in the bright and the dark,
no,
especially. And,
correct.
And we should say we're not talking about like those really ancient paintings in Egypt or wherever where everything is flat. I mean, there could still be perspective, a sense of certain things in the painting are more distant than others, but everything feels like it's, in a sense, lit exactly the same way. There aren't dark shadows and so on.
Right, right. Almost like regular daylight or light in any regular room, where he would take it further and there would be like a dark room with a candle on the table and the face would be lit by that candle, but everything around would be dark. And I was just fascinated by the story that could be told with the light. And even in college, when I was drawing the models in the life drawing sessions, the way the light would hit the model is what was fascinating me, as opposed to the structure of the model themselves. And so what I started doing was, regardless of subject matter that I painted, it was always about that light and dark contrast in the work. And you'll see that in most of the work that I do now.
Yeah, and it is really a hallmark of your work, that is for sure. I want to mention, before I forget, and I'll remind people at the end, that you have a wonderful website. It's your first initial and your last name, so dsimino.com.
Yes.
And you have a number of different galleries in which people in that sort of slideshow format we're getting used to now on websites can see a number of your paintings in various different series that you have done. And we do see that again and again, the play of light in the image. And in many cases, the light itself, I mean, the source of the light, we don't see.
No,
that's
correct.
In a sense off stage, but the light illuminates whatever is the object or the person in the painting. Is that as difficult to achieve as it sure seems like it would be? As, I mean, from my amateur perspective, that seems like a very difficult thing to achieve with perfection and precision.
It can be. I was just reading an article from another artist just this week that put it very well, that when you're working on a piece like this with such an intensity between the light and the dark, what this artist suggested, which is good for any aspiring artists or people who want to go down this road, is capture your brightest bright and your darkest dark right at the beginning stages of your painting. Get those down on the canvas. And from that point, you now have the scale in the middle to work from, which makes a lot of sense. And I do very similar in my approach. I will sketch my work out, and in the very first washes where I cover the entire canvas with paint without being realistic in any way, I capture the lights and darks right away to get that tonal scale set early on in the artwork.
Interesting. So can we turn to one of the paintings that is behind you?
Sure.
And kind of talk about that specific element?
Sure.
And I'm going to leave it up to you. I mean, I think the matter of light and dark plays a bit more dramatically in one of these paintings versus the other, but
yes.
Maybe you want to talk about that element in both of them.
Yes. The two paintings I have here are a still life called Bag of Grannies and a figurative work called Every Thought We Think Is Creating Our Future. The figurative piece covers the light dark much more dramatically. When I photograph my models come from all over the country. So I typically will photograph and work from photographs. And this particular piece is a back hallway in my studio building. It's called the Racine Business Center. And there is this one hallway that I just love, that the window is covered with the heavy plastic year-round.
Mm.
So it diffuses the light. And so the hallway itself is in late afternoon, gets kind of dark because the walls are painted gray, but there's this incredible bright, soft light that comes through that plastic. And this particular piece emphasizes that light. And in the piece, you'll see a lot of dark shadow on the face, almost getting to a black. And then the reflected light up in the neck to capture the glow of the skin. And that's what I really wanted to capture in this piece, was that glow. And I wanted to capture this serenity in the face of the model and just the posture of the model, just pondering the future, what's coming.
I love this painting. One of my questions for you is, for instance, when we look at his face and the sharp contrast between the brightness at the front of his face and then the really dark shadow to the side and kind of the cheek area, is that what it looked like? Is that very literally representative of what the light was doing? Or is that, in a sense, a bit of artistic license that you're taking as the painter?
Well, the glow on the neck is a little more emphasized. It wasn't as obvious as you see here. But I still, in emphasizing it, want to keep it natural, as if that's how it could have been. But if I had kept it with less reflected light, the piece wouldn't have the impact that it has. So I wanted to make sure that was really important in the piece.
Right. It's so striking to me because in some ways when I look really carefully at that, I wonder, it's what prompted the question. Is that really what it looks like when somebody stands in that hallway? And is there that sharp contrast? And it just underscores the fact that you as the painter are capturing images that the rest of us otherwise don't see, or we see them and we don't realize that we're
exactly
seeing them.
Exactly. And a lot of my work, even early on, that was another one of the missions I had. It wasn't just the painting with the light, but it was also painting everyday objects in such a way to make people look at something they take for granted or don't pay attention to day to day. And the second piece here is an example of that. The piece called Bag of Grannies is just some apples I brought home from the grocery store in one of the plastic bags that they have in the produce department. I lit it with some spotlights in my studio and wanted to capture the, how do I describe it? The crinkliness of the plastic bag.
And if that's not a word, it should be.
It should be. And the reflection of light on that plastic. That was the focus. In a lot of my work, I tend to look for something I don't understand and seek to understand it through painting it. So in this case, the reflection on the plastic and how to capture that effectively and still get the translucency through the bag to see what's inside the bag.
Absolutely. And I love this painting as well. And it's really cool to see this crinkled up plastic bag that we get at the grocery store. But I also find my eye drawn to these beautiful granny apples and also the play of light and shadow that you have done there. And for that matter, just the myriad shades or hues of green that we see in those apples. I mean, what kind of effort does it take to create that sort of effect down to that sort of fine level?
To me, a lot. As you can see, there are a lot of transitions of green in that. You typically think, oh, it's a green apple. But there's a lot more going on there. There's reflected light. Anything that could be in the vicinity is impacting the color of that apple, so it's not a pure green. So here you'll see some almost like a peach tone, some yellows, a little bit of red, some blue reflecting in there. A lot of colors, but the core comes across to you and reads green when you look at the painting.
Yeah, it's just great. Love it, love it. I want to shift back to the other painting for a moment. So again, this is an example of your figurative art, and this is a real hallmark of the work that you do.
Yes.
And in particular, you often paint the male figure.
Yes.
And I read a statement of yours on your website, I believe, where you say something to the effect that the male figure tends to be neglected in the world of art. And once upon a time, that was not the case. But for whatever reason, it seems to be now. Tell us more about
Correct.
That.
Correct. If we think back to ancient art, the Greeks, the Romans, even the Renaissance work, there was a lot of male figurative work. They were actually probably more prominent than the female work at that point. And then when we got into, I would say, this is my opinion only, not art history, into the Victorian time, we started seeing more figurative work that involved females. The French Impressionists, for example, Monet, Manet, Degas painted females. Hmm. And you started seeing males go away. Van Gogh continued the practice of still painting men, painting the people that he knew around him. But then something happened. I don't know why or what, but you saw in more contemporary times, the male figure basically vanished from the art world. If you went to galleries or exhibits, you didn't see the male figure. It was always the female. And I didn't understand that. And then once I started exhibiting or speaking with mentors about my work, something came across that really threw me. And speaking to other artists of male figurative work, the same thing happened to them. Galleries didn't want to represent their work because they saw it as gay art, which was kind of odd because when I see what I term gay art, it's much more sexual in nature or has that undertone.
Right.
Where a lot of us who paint the male figure are painting everyday scenes.
Right. Well, like what you brought with us
correct.
Today.
I mean, yeah. With none of that sexual undertone to them. But galleries will push away from that. They don't want to exhibit it. It's starting to change a little bit now, which is a good thing. And we just don't understand, but there's a group of us that are trying to get male figurative work back where it should be in the art world.
Yeah. So, for instance, this gentleman that you've painted in this particular painting, again, titled Every Thought We Think Is Creating Our Future. I love that title. So this is one of the models that you use, I think, on a regular basis.
Yes, this is my muse. Ah. His name is Johnny, and he's from Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
And he'll come once a year to do a photo shoot with me to give me inventory for paintings for the next year.
I happen to have a pretty good friend who does some of this actually at Carthage and other places. That is, he will be a model for life drawing classes. And because I know him and the work that he does, it's left me kind of intrigued by what it takes to be a model in these sorts of scenarios. I mean, are there particular talents or gifts or skills that one brings to the table? I mean, for instance, this young man from Columbus, Ohio, what are his attributes that make him, for you, an effective and even inspiring model?
For me, there has to be a connection with the model. And for me...
Just person to person?
Person to person, yeah. I need to have... I don't know how to describe it, but I need to feel something toward them. And he comes across as a very old soul. He has just an amazing spirit and really a gentle person. When I was in college, I was drawing and painting models, like you mentioned, life models for the classes that were from the professional art dance troupe in the area. And so I got to really appreciate the sculptural form of the lean figure that was very well toned. So not a bodybuilder and not someone who has no muscle tone at all, but right in the middle.
Right.
And he is one of those people. The muscle is very not defined, but evident. And so with the whole play of light against the figure, that's what I look for, something that can define the figure and show all of this sculptural intricacy. Rather than, for example, a lot of people ask, why do I don't paint the female? And that's a big part of it, is the female, by nature and by cultural desire, has a softer form with less light and dark transitions across the figure. So I look for that sculptural quality in the models.
Interesting.
Several of my models are dancers. Or do dance, and the models need to have an understanding of their body and understanding of how light affects their body. If they can't pose right, it's not going to come across the way I want it to.
Right. And in a typical session with a model, are you very specifically directing them, I mean, with a certain intent in mind? Or is it, in a sense, more free-flowing and spontaneous that you, in a sense, see what happens or see what poses they come up with themselves? I mean, in a sense, who is directing whom in that process?
It's a blend, and it also depends on the model. I have some models where I need to direct constantly, which for me is very tiring. I prefer a model where I will just give a concept or an idea of where I want to go and let them flow with it. Those are usually the best sessions for me. I have a model in Chicago that's that way. I gave him a mood I wanted to capture. He turned on some music and just went there. And I just basically had to hold the shutter down and keep snapping. And everything was beautiful.
Wow.
This model, Johnny, is very much that way. I can give him an idea where I want to go. I may have some props sometimes, and he will just take it. And I just go very little direction, which is nice.
And you are painting from the photographs you take.
I paint from photographs because the paintings take 30 to 40 hours per painting, and my models coming from all over the country, they have to get back home. So what we'll do is, like I said, a photo shoot over a weekend. They'll stay at the house, and we'll do one or two photo shoots over that weekend, and then I have my inventory to work from. And a lot of people look at my work as photorealism, which is, in my opinion, not the case at all. The photo is a starting point and a reference, but if you were to see the original photograph and the final painting, you do see a difference between the two.
Interesting. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today with a renowned artist, painter, Dan Simoneau. We are talking about two paintings he brought with him to our WGTD studios this morning. And the occasion of this conversation is the opening of an exhibit of his work at the Blue Moon Gallery in Grays Lake, Illinois, an exhibit that will run from October 22nd to November 15th, an exhibit titled Quartet for Mind and Soul. Works in oil, acrylic, and watercolor. So
yes,
we'll see actually several different sides of the work that you do as a painter. I wanted to make sure to give you an opportunity to talk about an element of social justice that is part and parcel to some of the most powerful works that you have created. When I visited your website and was viewing, for instance, the gallery of figurative paintings, the one that leapt out at me more than any, although I really enjoyed many of the things I saw there, was a painting titled Who's Next? I'd like you to describe to our listeners what one sees when they view this painting that you've titled Who's Next?
Okay. Who's Next is one of the models I was just talking about from Chicago, who just inspires me so much. He's a young black man, and the painting itself shows him against a black background wearing a black and white striped shirt, lit from the sides with some red lighting, and his hands are up on top of his head. And his face is somewhat in shadow. You can't see his eyes, for example. And you just feel a tension or a concern or a distress when you look at the piece.
I was going to say anguish. One can just sense that this young man is feeling anguish for some reason or another. And we don't really know until we see the title of the painting. And then we can kind of imagine what that anguish is stemming from.
And the black and white shirt is pulled up slightly as well, so you see his abdomen, and you see the wrinkles in the shirt. And the title actually came from the model. There were, a year and a half ago, I would say, a series of shootings of unarmed black men by police. And this was happening in Chicago and across the country, and several of my models are black men. And I hear from each of them as we're working during our photo shoots of instances where they will just be walking down the street and police will stop them and start interrogating them. What are you doing? Why are you here? This neighborhood's not typically black. What are you doing here? And just this constant persecution of them just for being who they are, it was really getting to me. And the model, when all the shootings were taking place, had posted on social media, "Who's Next?" with hashtag Who's Next. Mm. And I said, that's the title of the piece. Mm-hmm. And the red light that you see represents the lights from the police cars, the ambulances, and so forth. There are more pieces in that series. There's another one called Reaching, which also has the same model in the same shirt, reaching forward out of darkness, again, with a look of concern on his face. A piece that's in progress that won't be in the show, unfortunately, is called The Scream, and it's the same model, and it's like he's tearing his body apart. The face is wide open mouth screaming, and his hands are on his chest kind of pulling apart. And it's his reaction to one of his friends or family members being killed as a result of one of these incidents.
Wow. We should mention, I don't want to forget this fact, that at this exhibit at the Blue Moon Gallery in Grays Lake, Illinois, they're at the reception on the 26th. There will be a literal unveiling of a new work, and that new work is part of this series.
It is. The new piece is called Tug of War, and it shows the divide between whites and blacks in society and my perception of what's going on with race relations in this country.
I want to be sure to ask you about a couple of other facets of the work that you do that can be seen on your website. There are some paintings there that are under the heading of moments, and they are paintings that are in a, I think you call it a much simpler style, maybe a little more raw. Just say a quick word about what's sort of behind these paintings and what it feels like for you to create them versus the kind of highly detailed paintings that are in our studios today.
Well, as I mentioned, when I do series of works, I want to learn something that I don't know or don't understand. And in college, ever since I've been painting, actually, I've always been a realist. And what I wanted to do about, I think it was in 2017, I had a solo show at the Kenosha Public Museum, and there were 41 works of large-scale figurative pieces there that were realistic. I needed a break. I needed to just unwind a bit. And because I had never painted in a more abstract or impressionistic style, I wanted to learn how to do it. And typically, because of how I paint, you always want to go back in and do more work and do more work. So what I did is I set a time limit. Each of the paintings in this particular series was done in 1 hour or less. And it, I set the timer, and it forced me very quickly to get the core of the piece down and just the elements that were necessary to define what that was and nothing else. I actually teach a course on this method of painting now. I'm actually teaching it this weekend at the Kenosha Public Museum. I call it an express painting course, and I give my students more time. I give them 2 hours to finish a painting. But I will actually demo a painting in the class and then show that, give them 2 hours to complete their own.
Wow. That sounds exciting. You also have abstracts. I mean,
yes.
Abstracts, I mean, in which it, there is no bowl of fruit or bag of fruit or no model. It is absolutely abstract. What does that feel like artistically to you? I've always been intrigued by abstracts, but particularly in your case when you are so renowned for what would seem to be kind of the polar opposite of that kind of artistic expression.
Abstract is, to me, very difficult. Yeah. I had to do an abstract painting in college. And I absolutely hated it. It was like going to the dentist. It was awful. And I hadn't painted abstract since then, since college. And then happenstance, my best friend bought a new house in Texas, and I offered to do a painting for Over the Fireplace. And I said, I'll do a portrait of you and your family. And he says, that's too stuffy. I don't want that. I said, okay, what do you want? And he said, I want a black and white abstract. And I said, you know who you're speaking to, right? I don't do that. So I decided to play, and we had an artist in our studio building that had moved out and left a bunch of mediums, acrylic mediums to work with. And I grabbed a bunch, and I just put canvases on the floor, started throwing stuff around, playing with it. And one thing I learned is even though it's difficult for me to go that road, you still use the core foundation of any artwork with composition, light and dark tone balance, as you mentioned, color balance. It all still plays in. So if you have that foundation with your realistic work, the abstract work will be a good painting as well as a result.
Last question. I wish we had more time for you to answer this in more thorough fashion. What is it like for you to sell a painting and, in effect, give up a painting that you have labored over for such a long time and a painting that you might really love? What does that feel like?
It used to be difficult. It's not anymore. Because I paint because I have to. I tell people a lot, and in my statement, I say art is like air for me. I need it to survive. So I create, but the end goal is to give someone else a sense of satisfaction and happiness. So if any of my work gets sold and goes into another home where someone's going to appreciate it and love it and admire it, that's what it's all about.
Very nicely put. What a great philosophy that helps us make even more sense of this wonderful career that you have enjoyed. We want to remind our listeners that this new exhibit of your work, Quartet for Mind and Soul, works in oil, acrylic, and watercolor, will be opening at the Blue Moon Gallery in Grays Lake, Illinois, October 22nd through November 15th, with a special opening reception on Saturday, the 26th of October. How many pieces altogether in this exhibit?
There will be 49 pieces.
Wow, a big, big show. And at that exhibit on the 26th, an unveiling of a brand new painting never before seen in the public. And again, we also want to direct people who want more information about the work that Dan Cimino does to go to his lovely website, which is dcimino.com. Dan Cimino, I knew this would be fun. I honestly didn't realize it would be this much fun. I mean, this has been a terrific conversation in so many ways. I've learned a lot and have enjoyed this thoroughly, as I'm sure our listeners and viewers have as well. I really appreciate you taking the time out of what I know is a very busy schedule to be part of the morning show. It was great to have you here. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back jackandrea.com.